There is a tried and true means of Bible study suggested by the Ignatian tradition and known well among Jesuits, in which the discipline is to place oneself in the story being told. Consider, if you will, through that lens, the story we heard Dr. Raisi read this morning from the latter chapters of Genesis, the encounter between Joseph and his brothers. Joseph's brothers have a lot to answer for, and I take their place in this story. Those brothers, at the beginning of the story, did not like the favor Joseph had found in the eyes of their father. After all, he was the youngest. By rights, he should have come last in line when it came to his father's attention or the division of his property. But even by the time Joseph was just about finishing high school, his older brothers could tell that Jacob, their father, preferred him. There was something else they didn't like about Joseph. Joseph was smart. He was smart, but not smart enough to know it might be better to hide how smart he was. He had ideas. He had standards. His brothers dissed him as a dreamer. He was the kind of guy who somehow just rubs everybody the wrong way. So they did something about it. It probably started out as a sibling prank, but it pretty quickly got out of hand, and it ends up with Joseph first at the bottom of a pit and then being hauled out of that trap by his brothers and sold by them as a slave to some passing traders. Joseph's brothers quite literally sold him down the river, or at least down a desert path. We are at the other end of the story today, and it's a story that is kind of familiar, but maybe not entirely familiar. It's a story about revenge that doesn't happen, or about scores that don't get settled. It is a story about reconciliation, what it costs, and what makes it possible. Joseph turns out to do just fine in his new situation. He comes to it by means of a great injustice, but his gifts serve him well, and soon enough he rises to the top in his new circumstances. The text tells us he becomes the head of Pharaoh's household in Egypt. So literally, from the bottom of a pit to the top of the heap. It might be enough to just leave the story there, but the injustice that the story springs from has to be addressed. And some years later, under extremely different circumstances, the brothers who so wronged Joseph now stand before him as supplicants, not even knowing how deep is the hole in which they now find themselves. They have no idea that the king's minister to whom they are pleading their case is in fact the annoying brother that sheer envy drove them to destroy. I suppose if this story were being told today, the end of it would have been decided by some kind of popular poll. You know, at the commercial break, right before the end of the story, we'd all have to whip out our cell phones and text 44134, let them go, or 44154, throw all of them into their own pits, or 44174, make them all fight it out in a steel cage death match. There really is something about the denouement of the story between Joseph and his brothers that is perfectly suited for reality television. It is like something straight out of a Jerry Springer show. Except that it doesn't end that way. It doesn't end in a way that seems remotely believable, because the way it ends involves an almost superhuman act of forbearance and forgiveness. Joseph forgives his brothers. That is the easy summary of the story. But there is a lot more here. First, he has to deal with the simple but profound fact that the burden they have been carrying from the knowledge of the wrong that they had done to their brother has quite literally blinded them. We are very good at doing things we know are wrong, and even better, at justifying ourselves in the doing of them. We are even better at remorse, at knowing that we messed up when we gave in to our worst instincts. But the problem with that self-awareness, with that moral conscience that always seems to arrive just a little late for the party, is that too often, the only way we can figure out how to deal with the knowledge of our own shortcomings, dare I say, our own sin, is to build defenses against that knowledge. We either become blind and deaf, or self-justifying, or what is worst, righteously indignant. Whatever the symptom, the cause is the same. We are unable to be at peace with ourselves. Because while we can commit the fault, we are never able to pretend with great success that we did not. All we can do is try to come up with some way of insulating ourselves from the reality of our failure. And the result is that we nurse a kind of disgust with ourselves. We have known from the earliest part of this story that Joseph is uncannily wise. He has visions. He interprets the dreams of others. He accurately predicts both prosperity and poverty, and wisely counsels the king to make preparations for famine. Joseph is a man who sees things as they really are, appearances to the contrary notwithstanding. So, when his own brothers, the brothers who sold him into slavery, don't even recognize him, he knows exactly why. It is because to recognize him would mean having to recognize the full weight of their own mistake. They have had years of nurturing their own anger at themselves to make that now impossible. So, Joseph ends up doing it for them. Only he can do this, because he was the one so badly wronged. He is the only one who holds the power to determine how the story will resolve. And this is what he says. Do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. This may all seem like a story about a group of people in a place far away and a time before imagining that has nothing to do with us. But as soon as we leave this place this morning, we will be surrounded again with the human misery that comes as the bitter fruit of wrongs for which the solution seems only to be revenge and not reconciliation. Whether it is the violence between peoples of differing faiths, or the violence between communities separated by race and inequality, we are surrounded by examples of endless cycles of revenge. And it seems as though, somehow, this summer, we can nearly see the edge of the abyss into which it all seems to be sliding. Joseph gives us hope, gives us an example, gives us a way out of our mess. All of us have lost our virtue in various ways and to various degrees. All of us have been the cause of someone else's injury, and all of us have been injured, and all of us end up in possession of the power of a fundamental choice, whether to recoil from our own fault by claiming that greater wrongs have been done to us, or live the virtue of forgiveness. By choosing that course, by living out that virtue, Joseph exercises the greatest power of all, the power to change the direction of a story that otherwise would be trapped in the tragedy of our thirst for revenge. He does not pretend the wrong was not done. He does not belittle the injury and say, "Oh, no worries, really, it was nothing," because it very much was something. He tells them, "I am your brother whom you sold into slavery." But what he does is see that the burden his brothers are carrying is too much for them, and he relieves them of it directly. And in that simple and profound act, he shows himself to be the most powerful actor, the agent of grace, the person who can redeem the wrong and make possible a new and reconciled future. We need, God knows we need, more Josephs. Who better than us to follow that example? Amen.